Osiris.
Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
My name is Raylan Baxter. I am a human being. I am located in Pegram, Tennessee, on a chair made of wood, on a porch made of wood. What am I doing with my art these days? I'm making it, man.
And we're doing it.
We're doing it. I've always been able to wear the shoes well of pining for something that I've never had. It's like the final thing in the video game or something where you got to go get the third piece of the ocarina of time. And once you get it, everything falls into place. The kingdom is saved. The heart throb is found. Pure harmony and fucking holding hands walking down the road forever. Love, misery.
Often I wonder, why do we live and die? Why are we together tonight? Why, in a light so bright, you left me all alone in my basement? Shivering cold, I never felt so shivering cold. Often.
There goes the singing butterfly himself. Raylan Baxter is our guest this week on The Show on the Road. Thanks for being with us. I'm your host, Z Lupitin. And my voice is a little crispy from playing the first Dust Bowl Revival shows of the year. I just want to say a big thanks to the folks in New England who braved winter weather to come see us all the way in Maine, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island. It really warmed my jaded touring musician heart. Because you know what? It's been a little bit of a rough road for me the last few months, just trying to figure out where my place is in the pantheon of music right now. When you're a band that has been around over a decade, there's a lot of great support that comes your way, but a lot of people also lose interest. And you change singers, you change trombone players, people drift away. And it is my job as a songwriter and a performer to bring new people in. And so I always say, if there's a band that you love, just tell one person that they exist and maybe bring them to a show. And one artist that I've been screaming to the rooftops about for the last 10 years is Mr. Raylan Baxter himself. And honestly, this new record, If I Were a Butterfly, took a little time for me to dive into. It is a challenging, squirrely piece of art. And I think that's kind of where my head is at right now, so I really need it. And, you know, listening to this record makes me think about how humans also transform, like the caterpillar into the butterfly. We don't know how we end up where we do, and yet we do. I thought I would be a novelist. I thought I would be in the movies, and yet here I am in dark bars telling stories to strangers, and it feels like the greatest job in the world when it does work. And it only works if people somehow find you in the darkness to hear the stories told. Maybe the most heartbreaking thing about our modern music landscape is that double-edged sword we always have to go into battle with. On one hand, there's so many ways for people to discover your music. On the other hand, there are millions of songs uploaded onto the cloud every moment of every day. How can they find your song? Why would you listen to my story? Maybe it's about finding out exactly how the transformation in our lives takes place. First, a caterpillar, it actually digests itself, releasing enzymes to dissolve all of its tissues, according to Scientific American. And if you were to cut open a cocoon or a chrysalis at just the right time, they write, a caterpillar soup would ooze out. but it's anything but an amorphous mess. Certain highly organized groups of cells known as imaginal discs survive the digestive process. We are who we are from the moment we are born, in a way. Before hatching, when a caterpillar is still developing inside its egg, it grows an imaginal disc for each of the adult body parts it will need as a mature butterfly or moth. Its eyes, its wings, its legs. And now, when I look at my one-year-old daughter, yes, little JJ turned one last week when I was on the road, I can only imagine what greatness is to come. Well, there's plenty of greatness being written by Mr. Raylan Baxter, and I can't wait to go on this ride with you. Okay, here he is, Raylan Baxter.
It's such a pretty thing, oh, but lately it's been hard to find. For I can taste it when the wind blows in, and I can see it hiding on the mountainside.
You know, when we create records that you're talking about as like, this represents who I am right now, but really it represents you in this little microcosm 2.5 years ago or something, or sometimes 10 years ago, and then it all kind of filters through this tiny funnel that we now get to hear.
Yeah, well, but it is interesting. Hopefully one is making art that they can, that represents them through the entire, you know, discography and life. Like, I still relate to my first record in a major way, just kind of like the memory was made and the album is still there, the first one, but, and it's still a part of my daily life. Like, who I am now is who I am then. And it's just like kind of grows like a bush or something, you know, more fruits, more sunrises, more sunsets. I'm still the same bush.
A burning bush that keeps burning?
Yeah, I wouldn't go that far. If I got burned, it hurts, and then I think we'll burn down. That's for the biblical mysteries, man. However, I would like to think that what I'm doing, or what any artist is doing, is as grand and as reportable as the burning bush.
Well, yeah, if you go back to your first record, Feathers and Fishhooks, which is over, you know, it's, what, 11 years old now?
It's 10 and a half years old. Yeah.
A song like Olivia is almost like an old friend, right? That you can always sort of call on, that people know that they have this sort of relationship with, that maybe feels old to you now, but some people are just finding out about it this week, right? The way streaming works, of course, you know, Spotify, they're like, they force you to listen to the most popular of whatever your work is. You don't get to choose that. You know,
right?
So it's like, here it is, Yellow Eyes, Olivia, Willie song, songs that are these little microcosms of you a decade ago, but people mm-hmm. are getting to know you almost like in various parts of the past, like a cubist painting put together, you know.
Right. I mean, I think the same thing with like the Rolling Stones or something. Like, somebody may not hear Sweet Virginia until like 50 years after it's come out, but they've heard all the other ones, you know. And I don't know, life can, you hear a good song whenever you're meant to hear it, I suppose.
I'm in love again. Oh, Olivia, love, won't you be my friend? Yeah, I'm in love again.
And If I Were a Butterfly is the new record.
Yeah.
And, you know, you really took it upon yourself to obviously be the engine behind a lot of these songs, the main producer, the songwriter, obviously, but also put yourself in this unique environment, in this abandoned rubber band factory turned studio. You know, you used your environment, you used sort of almost like home audio from your past to sort of create this full sonic tapestry of your experience. I started listening again to a favorite record of mine, Tom Waits's Mule Variations. I'm not sure if you've ever listened to that one. And there's something about this record that really strikes me, like that they're on the same plane somehow, where you have these very dark and direct kind of rocky funk kind of songs with these radio vocals, and then these super tender piano ballads to sort of balance them out somehow, you know, like you're telling stories from both sides of a broken love story and a past.
Yeah, well said. That's it, man. You know, there's that, like, I think it was the first or second Lost Boys record where he starts it off and he's talking to some guy in a subway, and the guy asks him what kind of music he makes, and he says, "I make music the way I am, my man." And that's like, that's it. And this record was the first one where I got to make music without having to follow anybody's guidelines. You know, really the guidelines were lifted when COVID started, and then I had an extra 2 years to work on the record, which I took advantage of, and I just dug into a hole and started laying tile, and that's it, man. That's what came out of it. It is like a very accurate representation of who I am and what it sounds like in my head. And I was able to, like, I was learning how to use Pro Tools during this time, and I was editing a bunch, and I grew up listening to Beck. And so I liked, like, how he kind of turned his voice into a DJ kind of thing, you know, like very complete. Yeah. And so that was fun. I was just by myself for the most part, you know, and I didn't want to see anybody. And I had all these tools in this studio, and I had the nature outside, and I went through four seasons making this. I mean, at least in the last year, starting in December of 2020 to December of 21, I spent that whole year like digging in the studio for the most part by myself. You know, it was great. I would not do it again, but it was a great time.
Well, I think when you have that isolation that a lot of us were forced to go into during the first year or so of COVID, there's a sense of freedom, but a sense of madness that can kind of come into it too. Which I think we get that sense in those first few tracks. I mean, that opening track, it's not like an easy, friendly track to drop us into this record. I mean, you have obviously yourself as a child singing, but it's like a long, sprawling, at times almost scary journey, right? And we're talking about this theme, I think, in that first song of like, are we lost? Are we lost again? Like, have you lost your mind? Have you lost your friends? You know, in 2020, you lost your father. You know, it's like, like who are we? What is tying us down? And if we could be like this tiny creature, we could just fly away and get away from it all, but you can't. You have to be inside your own head. That's like, you have no choice.
Yeah,
it's not I am a butterfly, it's if I were.
You know, like, I mean, who doesn't want to fly away? The idea of just like, man, I wish I could fly. From a little kid, like, well, where would you fly to? I'd fly away. Well, what's that away? Probably more problems. So, and more new forms of beauty. So, it's like at the end of it, I've learned, as much as I would want to fly away or ever wanted to fly away, like, you don't fly away. You it's all here, you know. And some shit you got to deal with and take care of and be responsible with, so that you can experience joy and give joy. And then some stuff is already there in place from maybe proper parenting or a good group of friends. But like, life is this record that we're talking. If I see it in 3 seconds, it's a caterpillar covering himself up and becoming a butterfly. or an angel, you know. It's like, you know, not only did I lose my old man, but 2 years prior to that, the owners and the creators of Thundersound Studio, they both died within 3 months of each other. And they did, one died accidentally and one died on purpose. And there was the one that died on purpose left because he was heartbroken from the one that died accidentally. They were best friends.
Mm.
And it just drove him mad. And so it was like, there's a lot of life and death in a quick caterpillar's life, you know, like in a butterfly. I don't know how long butterflies live, but, and that was it. Like, it was just, yeah, I don't know. I could talk forever about it, honestly.
But when you go back to that line, all I feel, all my thoughts, are we lost? And then later on, tell me everything you know, are we lost again? You know, what does that lostness feel for you? Like, where is that coming from?
Well, it comes from, you know, start like with the two guys I was just mentioning, Billy Swayze, not being able to see him come around the corner in the studio and be like, oh, damn, that's good, Ray. Or damn, Ray, you got to play the bass in the pocket, man. You're wiggling around too much, man. Keep it in the pocket. Keep it in the box. And also, like, not being able to call my dad, you know, that's a huge one.
Yeah.
For 39 years, for 37 years, he is my phone call. If I got jittered, if I got uncomfortable, if I was comfortable and wanted to share something, you know, I would call him out of the gate, just bing, bing. And so I still, like, to this very day, I wake up and I'm like, man, I wish I could call him. And I feel lost, you know. It's like, it's, but what am I going to do other than find out how to access him in a different realm and learn how to trust what I got inside of me so I don't feel lost and so I don't feel incomplete, you know, and alone, you know. Like, he's my dad and I are the same guy. We hear music the same. We play music the same. I think I probably play a little bit more than him and in a bad way, you know, but that comes with age. And I see a tree the same way he does and a bend in a river the same way he does. And so when he died, I lost like that friend to share something with, or to know that on this planet, there's somebody that is very attached to me and vice versa. So I think that would be like kind of where the lost is, but also during COVID, man, we were all lost. We had never experienced anything like that in our lifetime. And so everyone was like, can I get near you? I used to love you. I love you still. Are you going to die tomorrow? Should I cough into my sleeve when I'm in a coffee shop? You know, all that stuff was just like weirded us all out.
Well, yeah, there's this other line that I saw maybe as a through line or maybe just accidental. Oh my God. All I feel, all my thoughts. And then that line in Graffiti, all I do is mumble, oh my God, on repeat, right? This sort of mystical confusion that we all have, like, are we all going to be wiped out tomorrow? Or maybe this will pass and we have to like actually wrestle with what's really going on.
Yeah. I know when my dad passed, all I could say was, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, and Papa. And that's it, man. I said that for 4 days until I got into his house and had kind of like an amazing, miraculous spiritual moment where I spoke with him for 2.5 hours in his house. All I could say is, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. You know, it's like this long like acceptance. But you know, when shit's fucked up, people say, oh my God, you know?
Yeah. It'd be funny if like Jesus came back, you know, if he like rose from the dead, like they said, and everyone was just like, they fell down the stairs and they're like, Jesus Christ. He's like, man, that's not really how I thought this was going to go.
That's funny.
Like, are they saying that like in a good way? Or?
Jesus Christ. Yes, I am.
That's me.
Yeah. So keep your balance.
For folks who don't know, your dad, Bucky, you know, played with Bob Dylan and all sorts of folks, but can you tell us a little bit about him and maybe how, you know, he influenced you or shaped you musically?
Yeah. My dad, he's a pedal steel player among other instruments, but he's one of the original Dukes of Steve Earle and the Dukes back in the 80s, Guitar Town and Copperhead Road, which is a big alt country, the birth of alt country. I mean, kind of, you know, Waylon Jennings, I guess people would say, and all that stuff. But I played with Steve Earle for 10 years, played with Bob Dylan for 10 years. He played on some Sheryl Crow hits, and he played with the Beastie Boys and Los Lobos and Ryan Adams. Not like a country pick and pedal steel player, but he always managed to play the right thing. And he was known to be a great band member because he always played the right thing. He listened very well to music, and he just kind of like had a lot of trust and faith in the powers that we cannot explain. And he loved to go on fishing trips. But he taught me a lot about music. When I moved back to Nashville 14 years ago, I was just starting to play music. And so he would play with me every show I had. We would write songs together, and he would kind of like constructively critique me after the shows. And that, you know, I had a big advantage in comparison to my contemporaries, because my dad, in comparison to most of my contemporaries, I just had Bucky as like, he played for some of the greatest songwriters that we know of. Steve Earle, Bob Dylan, Ryan Adams, as much as he's like getting some flack right now, that guy made some killer records that created the new Nashville. And so he saw how these guys stood. He saw how they carried themselves in interviews and how they carried themselves before and after shows. And so I was able to kind of like just learn from them through him.
Mm-hmm. He's like the special sauce in a lot of these bands, you know?
Yeah,
like
big time.
The butter on top.
Bucky, the butter on top, Baxter, there you go.
So that track, Graffiti, the line, "No surprise, you're finally alive."
Graffiti Street.
Yeah, Graffiti Street. It's like, was that about sort of seeing your dad come back in that conversation, or was that a totally different moment?
That's more a song about Billy Swayze. And you know, Billy, when he passed, he was running from the law like he'd been running from the law for the past previous years. You know, like the local cops in Franklin, Kentucky kind of were out to get him. But he's dancing in the heavens now, you know, playing rock and roll music. He was always transcendent. Like he was, when he played music, he was that pure music. He became music. And so, you know, I see him dancing on the rooftops, kicking his shoes off, having a good old time. And Graffiti Street is reference to Spray Paint Road, which is a nickname for Coomer Road, which is the street, or the road that studio is located on. And since the 70s, it's just been accepted by the county up there that you can go take spray paint and spray paint on the road, anything you want to. And for like 3 miles, the road's covered in spray paint. It's awesome. And so that's that, you know. He's alive now.
No surprise, you're finally alive. No surprise.
You know, talking about Steve Earle, it reminds me of the I got to interview him for this podcast in his tour bus.
And, hell yeah.
He had like this back table, and we sat at this little table, but it was hard to like put your feet down because he had about 150 cowboy boots all over the ground. Like like the rug was just cowboy boots for him to choose, yes. I guess, for the show, you know. And while he was doing the interview, he had two huge TVs watching the Yankees, like, whoa, baseball, like, and he would stop every like few minutes and just like analyze what was happening at the plate and then go back to the conversation.
That's awesome. Steve Earle is awesome, man. He he's had a long journey and was I discovered how fucking awesome he is beyond music when I just saw him on The Wire. He's an actor on The Wire.
Yeah.
And I was like, damn, that's Steve Earle. Acting real good. And he's kept on making records, and you know, unfortunately his son passed, and that's got to be a fucking just a situation to deal with when the son passes before the father. And
did you know Justin at all?
I did. I didn't know him well, but we have like probably fading childhood memories together. But I toured with him in Sweden in like 2014 or 2015. We did a Rolling Thunder review-esque called the Rolling Rootsy review. And they got a big like love for Americana music out there in bluegrass. Yeah. So there were seven bands that traveled in four different vans, and we popped around from city to city, and the stage was already set up and we played, and it was a good time. Justin was there.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking, I think, seeing a tortured soul, I guess you could call him, like, not be able to make it through to be able to create music as an older songwriter like his dad. Like, we'll never know what he's gonna write on the other side of it because he's not here, you know. A lot of people
that's his journey, make it through.
yeah
that's his journey. I was listening to some radio show like Across America or something. I forget this dude, but he was talking about how and before we were born back, before we're reincarnated, we're given four exit points. We choose to leave this life at four exit points. We pick one. And so since hearing that, whether it's true or not, I've looked at death like, all right, well, my dad, before he was reincarnated to be Bucky Baxter, to be William Baxter, he chose that spot to leave. And that's when his lesson and his teachings was up. And so I think about maybe Justin, without him knowing now, he chose that exit. And, you know, kind of like in Big Fish, when you look into the lady's eye and you see how you die. I don't think it helps anybody out to know how they die, but it makes it easier to think that it wasn't like completely accidental.
I think, you know, obviously people have made some comparisons to the Beatlesque quality of this new record. Maybe, you know, an Abbey Road, a White Album vibe. But not a lot of people do this, but when you reference a song that hasn't come up yet in the album order, like My Argentina, but you're referencing the same lines in Dirty Knees, right?
Yeah.
And I didn't realize that, obviously, until I came back around. But you have almost like these two different viewpoints. In Dirty Knees, you have like almost a bebop trumpet, you know, an old smoky jazz club sort of slam poetry reading, you know. And then My Argentina, obviously, a much more tender, unrequited love song feeling. How did you want to connect those two things together, or did it sort of happen accidentally?
It was accidentally. Like, so the night before we recorded Dirty Knees, I recorded My Argentina by myself on a piano, and we had made arrangements to, as a band, to attempt recording My Argentina the next day as a band. And so Dirty Knees is our sound check. And it's just all of us sitting in the room jamming and for like 30 minutes on this groove. And I had all my sheets of songs and lyrics that I was flipping through while we were just jamming. I started freestyling. And then it went off into the freestyle land where, you know, you say I could lay down here for hours, not go anywhere. And then all of the lyrics were jumped off of little platforms of already existing lyrics. And that's just a freestyle jam. And then I, of course, we were going to record My Argentina. So that was sitting there on the piano. And I decided to sing a little bit of that, unintentional, but that was fun. You know, that's how that came about.
Well, I could stare at you all day and sing into your beautiful face. Wanna open up my eyes, and all I wanna see is your eyes. But I want it, and you got it. I feel it kind of more. I feel it kind of more than I wanted to. Another beautiful instrument. The heart.
The idea that you know, you could sort of look into this person's eyes forever, but you don't know if they're ever gonna see you in the same way, right? There's definitely a thread of unrequited love, of yearning, of two people, two ships sort of passing each other in the current of affection and love and lust and, yeah, and desire. When you try to write a love song, do you see the person that you're writing about, or is it sort of more of a feeling, or an emotion versus this actual person?
Yeah, it's yes, it's more the feeling, you know, and just the pursuit of pure love and harmony with another human being. This should be education in schools, like how to survive in the woods, how to be nice to your partner, and how to understand other human beings. Like with tailgating, for example, when somebody's tailgating me, my immediate reaction is, motherfucker, get the fuck off my tail, man. God damn, what the fuck did I do to you? But maybe they just walked in on their husband or wife fucking somebody else. Or maybe their mother's in the hospital and they're on the way to the hospital. Yeah. Or maybe they're going through absolute world shit and it has nothing to do with the person that's being tailgated. You know, like understanding that in a relationship is also a gift that we can either teach ourselves or go to therapy to find out, or have our parents who love each other and who are nice to each other all up through the upbringing of a child to learn from, you know, but most people don't have that. So the tailgater is going to be the asshole, and the guy getting tailgated didn't do shit.
Well, I remember being a kid and seeing my parents, who, God bless them, are married almost 40 years.
That's amazing. Years,
40 years. And I remember looking at them and being like, how do these people even stay together? Like, they seem like they have literally nothing in common. They're arguing about the dumbest shit I've ever heard. Like, they seem like they honestly hate each other some of the time. Like, how is this a thing, you know? And then, of course, like the next day, they're like so perfect for each other. Obviously, they're going to be married for 40 years, you know? And I feel that way sometimes about me and my wife, you know? It's like you get into an argument sometimes and you're like, who are you? Like, why are you like this? I mean, this is like a thing that, like, I will say, you know, like, why are you the way you are, you know? And I think like that mystery, that frustration is why most art exists, right? Trying to figure out, like, how do I love you but also despise you sometimes?
Yeah,
like,
man.
You know, because the people who you really love are the people who get under your skin so deep, mm-hmm, that the smallest look, the smallest little bit of negativity just throws you so hard, you know?
Yeah, be like, you love me? No, you don't love me. You wouldn't do that if you loved me.
Why would you say that?
Yeah, but really, all of that is done. All of that is done, and it's like, well, how much do I love myself, and where do I find somebody else's? Where do I scapegoat that to, you know?
Well, the song that obviously, you know, really hit me hardest and a lot of people are gravitating to is Tadpole. And, you know, you're going back to when you were a kid and seeing this stuff happen around you, the beauty and simplicity of your childhood neighborhood and, you know, throwing paper airplanes on top of the church and but also feeling this sense of dread and death when you see this neighbor that, you know, kills herself. It's just these are the small moments that stack up to create who you are, you know. And, you know, when you started writing that, was there a point where you felt like you had to go to that moment where you heard that gunshot, or is it like almost too personal? Like sometimes it's so personal, it's painful, right?
I wrote that song with Kai Welch, who's one of the producers. We wrote like 4 songs that day, and that was the one that came out. We wrote it in the studio, and then we recorded it that day. We were like, oh, this is the one. And so I think that's not a dark moment, but it kind of is, I guess. Like some lady kills herself across the street from me. I didn't see her do it. I just heard the gunshot.
That's pretty terrifying. You know,
yeah, it was. I was so young that it's just like, you know, no big deal, kind of, I guess. At the time, I wasn't like, oh my God, mom.
Yeah, you just didn't even know.
Pulled those lights, and I was out on my bicycle the next day, you know? It's just you know, childhood shit, you know.
Ding dong, the witch is dead. All my neighbors whispering. The redder pulled the trigger on a quiet summer morning. The shot was loud enough for everyone to hear on Cleve Street. My mother wasn't home that day, so I cried. Every now and then I drive down my old street. Every now and then I stand barefoot in my old backyard. There I see my savior staring back at me. I wonder if I've changed at all since 1983. Oh.
Yeah, there's something about experiencing things that, as a kid, where there's so much passing by you, like you're on a highway, and the stimuli is flying by you. I see that in my little 11-month-old daughter. Like, we're doing all this stuff with her, right? We're like, you know, we're going to Hawaii, and like, you know, we're in Mexico, and then we're like, she's not gonna remember any of this. Like, all this really cool stuff has happened to her that most adults will never experience. She will have literally no memory of it. But I guess we have all these videos and photos. But it's fascinating because it's like when she opens a Christmas present, she doesn't care what's inside. She wants to play with the paper, you know. Like,
yeah,
she wants
the
sparkly wrapping is the most exciting thing, not the really cool toy that someone spent a bunch of money on.
Right. She's shaped by it all, man. She's shaped by your joy that you experience, you know this stuff when you're out there in Hawaii and like for the future, you know, the joy that you've experienced dipping your toes in the ocean with your daughter and your wife, you know, that's like, that'll go on to make you a better father when she's 12, I think, you know. And so she may not remember it other than the pictures, but it's like valuable time that goes on for decades.
What do you think is your earliest memory that you can actually think of? Like, how young?
Oh, probably like four or five, I think. Having a birthday party, my mom had a she buried fake crystals and pearls in the backyard of our house, and
yeah,
we had a pirate's booty. Like, we all dressed up as pirates for my 4th birthday. And all my friends from like preschool, I guess, or whatever, came over, and we had clues And I remember digging up holes in the yard, finding treasure. Like, we had a big wooded backyard when I was a little kid in Old Hickory. And that's, I think that's my earliest memory.
How is your mom's relationship with your dad being gone and being a musician?
Well, they were divorced when I was three. So they were like, you know, they didn't get along for a long time. And I remember my mom saw my dad for the first time in a decade, like 4 years ago. And I was just like, damn, y'all actually loved each other. Fucking weird. You know, my dad's like, hey, Claudia, how you doing? My mom's like, hi, Bucky. How are you? You know, yeah. Like, my mom's freaking radical, you know, don't get me wrong, by the sweet voice. Like, she's really smart and definitely, you know, ate acid before she had kids, you know, did the far out thing and was a hippie. And so that's why I think it worked. But, you know, life goes on and people grow up, and they definitely divorced because they came together to make two things, my sister and me. You know, that's why they got together. And, you know, she was pretty heartbroken too when he passed, but she had to step up to the plate for her kids and become a sweet mother. In our old age, you know, I'm almost 40 and my sister's almost 41. And so, you know, Claudia, my mom, she is like, she showed us kind of how spiritual she is that we didn't even know about.
Was there a type of music or a songwriter, something that you actually got from her versus your dad?
Oh man.
Like, what was her taste?
Like, her taste was all in excess. She liked in excess and classical music and like Joan Osborne. She was big into Joan Osborne, Tom Petty. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that was the first show I ever went to. Taj Mahal opened up. My dad got us tickets because he was already playing for Dylan at this point. It was at Starwood Amphitheater outside of Nashville. You know, a memory long gone. That amphitheater is like, I heard recently they're going to revive it, but it's like growing weeds and has cracks in the ceilings and yeah. And the foundation. But yeah, Tom Petty, Joan Osborne, and NXS. And then classical music, like, I don't even know, just classical music.
Yeah, I almost assume that, like, my mom, who doesn't, like, actively listen to music at all, like, I was like, oh, yeah, my dad gave me all the music that I love and influenced me as a songwriter and as a band leader. And then I realized, like, oh, yeah, my mom was playing all these cassettes in the car, Simon and Garfunkel, Ronstadt, Cat Stevens, Patsy Cline, like, all that stuff is now filtering in now, almost, you know, and that was all from her.
I forgot to mention, my mom is responsible for my first album. Here it is. My dad's buddy gave me a Megadeth CD when I was in kindergarten for my birthday, and I brought it home, and my mom's like, no, dude, no, no. So we went to Target and we replaced it. We returned it for Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And that was my mom's doing right there. And like, that's, there you go. You know, that set me off to the right path.
Isn't that funny how, like,
I probably wouldn't be talking right now.
It feels like boomer parents, it's like, did this great service to us, you know, late 30s songwriters, by like having Beatles be our children's music. Like, that was like the music we had as kids. I mean, it was like,
yeah.
And it feels like it is children's music in a lot of ways. It's playful, but it's also like,
mm-hmm.
you know, Helter Skelter is not a kid's song, but
yeah,
the it's like a Disney movie has great villains and darkness in it too. You know, I get concerned by, you know, going to daycare and my daughter's, you know, listening to this, like, da, 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 da. Like these, like, happy cheer. I'm like, turn this crap off. Like, why? Like, can't we get some more nuanced? Like, put on Sergeant Pepper.
Come on. Sun is the sky and brightness is the sun. And wee. Like, all right.
Was there, when you started touring, was there a show where you realized, like, this is really going to work. You start playing shows when you're younger, and then you're like, well, I'll do this for fun and then see what happens. Was there like a tour, a moment where you're like, oh, people are really getting behind what I'm doing?
Yeah. The first tour I did was the first legit tour I did was opening up for the Civil Wars in they put out two albums, but their first album, you know, it was like sold out shows everywhere from Seattle to from Seattle to Memphis, we played. And I would play solo. I'd open up solo and, you know, I was like doing something that people really were listening to. And so from the get go, you know, I realized like, okay, dude, I'm going to do this. I'm doing something that people are really gravitating to, and it's bringing them joy. It's making them cry. And I'm somehow emoting this type of thing. And for years I could only afford to go out by myself. So I would go out, like I opened up for Grace Potter and she's got a pretty rowdy, and I play solo, and I'd learn how to like get through the talking audience. And I opened up for Lauryn Hill for a few shows, and that solo, you know,
how did that come together?
Oh, we played the Electric Forest Festival up in Michigan one summer. And she walked by she was headlining that night, and she walked by our set in the woods. And I was playing with the band, four of my buddies, and we had all taken acid and Molly and we're like just rocking out. I had a bottle of Jameson. I was ripping down my guitar, and it was in this forest with a bunch of Chinese lanterns everywhere. And it just looked cool. And we were having a far out experience. And so she was like she was with her booking agent, from what I understand. She's like, we need them to come open up for us. And so I did two shows solo just because of the travel logistics. And then we played as a band, opened up for her in Louisville at a big amphitheater. So that's how that came about. It's cool as fuck, because she's cool as fuck. And she was like, she would stay after her set and say hi to every fan that stayed, man. Everybody. Wow. Everybody.
I feel like that song Rubber Band Man would feel really good in that frenzied, drugged out forest in Michigan. I feel like I would like to see that in that environment.
Yeah, I hope. I don't know if they do that. You know, they do that festival, but that was like when Electric Forest is more of an EDM festival. Sorry, I'm playing my dog. That's hippie. That's his hippopotamus, by the way.
Aww. Do you have a band in place for the shows that are coming up to play this record?
Yeah, all those guys that played on the record I'm touring with. Not all of them, but the drummer, Kyle Davis, he played on half the songs. The guitar player, Barney Cortez, he's my brother, you know, so he's coming out with us. And Todd Bolden, the bass player, he's touring. I've been touring with him and Barney for like 4 years, 5 years almost. Aaron Embry is going to play with us in LA, who's playing some ragtime piano. He played a bunch of the piano on that Mac Miller EP that I did. And Kai Welch, the other producer, is probably going to come out with us for some shows. And so, yeah, those guys are all like down. It's the first time I made a record with the band I'm touring with. And it makes it pretty easy. We don't have to rehearse at all.
Yeah, it's like a well-oiled machine.
Yeah.
Let's just say that 5 years from now, you're given the opportunity to start your own music festival. And you can do it wherever you want, anywhere in the world, any venue. And you get to put five acts to headline. How does it work?
Well, I've actually thought about this. It would be called Rayland. It would be located in Rayland, Ohio, which is in Northwest Ohio. There's actual city, a little town called Rayland, Ohio, spelled the same way. It would be, let's see, I put the Kingston Springs, they've dismembered. They put out one record. They're all friends of mine. But if you haven't heard of Ian Ferguson, he is one of the old members of this band that they put out an incredible record when they were in high school. Like this, the town that I live next door to right now, they would play. I'd have Liz Cooper play, and I'd have the Strokes play, and I would like to have, that's about, I guess I would have to play. So then there's one other band. I'd get the Osborne Brothers to play. Old bluegrass boys. I think they're all dead though. No, they're alive actually.
You can bring them back.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, shit.
This
in that
is
case.
Fantasy.
Okay. Fuck it. I'd have Grateful Dead play and I would just DJ. Boom.
If you could collab with your dad, bring him back for the festival for one song, what would you play together?
Let It All Go, man. The last track on Wide Awake. Yeah, definitely. That's kind of his motto. It's like, just keep her cool, Ray. Let it go, man. Let it go.
Good morning, everyone. Gather around, grab a chair. Make yourself a drink, blow your smoke into the air. Contemporary sadness and fire-breathing dragons are everywhere. But the days go by here in old Belvedere, and the way that it goes is just the way that it is. But do you ever wonder if anyone is ever gonna make it out? Is it wonder? Is it fame? Or is it popularity that ruins everything? Is the river not the rain? Why is everyone pretending that there's not a drop to drink? Well, there you are, holding on to everything. Let it all go, man. Let it all go, man.
Well, I'm really glad that you're making music on your own terms, and you know, Wide Awake is, I think, one of my favorite records of the last 10 years. I think it's a masterpiece, and I'm getting to know this new record, and you know, it's really cool stuff, man. And
thank you.
You are the first returning guest on the show on the road.
All right.
I think we're going to call this episode Raylan Baxter Returns.
Yeah, Returns.
Like Batman. Yeah, man. We'll keep up the good work, and we'll see you in April.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, bud.
Bye-bye.
The more I awake, the cracks in my hand and the lines on my face fail to remind me the frail and the blind see the same as me. Is it madness or is it fear? My brother, I'm not really sure after all these years. Is it wonder? Is it love? Or is everyone believing that it's under their control? Here we are, just waiting to explode. Let it all go, man. Let it all go, man.
There he goes, Mr. Raylan Baxter, everybody. You can go to RaylanBaxter.com for his newest record, If I Were a Butterfly, on ATO Records. And he'll be touring with his really awesome band. He'll be playing in Colorado in March at the Belly Up, in Englewood, in Salt Lake City, Boise, Seattle, San Francisco, and coming down here to California, playing Pappy and Harriet's March 31st and April 1st, No Foolin' at the Troubadour. I'm definitely going to check that one out. If you're curious what my band Dust Bowl Revival is doing, because of course you are, April 22nd, yes, we will also be at the Troubadour, our home base here in L.A., and actually going to be playing some really cool shows up the West Coast, Portland, Seattle, Sacramento, Santa Cruz, Berkeley, some shows with GA20, a really cool blues rock band from Boston, and with Grammy winner and friend of the show, Dom Flemons, including that show at the Troubadour. So please check that out, dustbowlrevival.com/tour.
Did you know that you can actually donate to the show to keep us going? Yes, check out the show notes on the podcast page. You'll see Red Circle as a way to send us a little cash to keep the lights on. And if you listen to music in the morning, yes, Saturday mornings, my radio show, the Sway Out West Radio Hour, is on 88.5 FM, the SoCal Sound here in LA, or you can stream it anywhere. I had a lot of fun last week playing a lot of music from Brazil. When we're on those long drives, we like to find music that maybe we've never heard in our entire lives. So if you have something I should hear, send me an email, showontheroadpod@gmail.com. That's it for me, folks. The Show on the Road is written, produced, and edited by yours truly, Z Lupitan, and we are a part of the BGS Podcast Network. We'll see you on the trail very soon with more episodes.
Hey, this is Steve Choi, host of the Musicians Guild Podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Within the four walls of the Musicians Guild, we'll be discussing the habits, idiosyncrasies, experiences, and general psychology of my friends and peers all involved with music in various capacities. Listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com.